thought that he would be fighting the male in the front for the female in the front. But then this new female had gotten into the back, causing Trevor to rethink the situation. He found both females attractive, and they both had an acceptable, if somewhat odd, aroma. But the one next to him had been feeding him. That told Trevor that she was receptive to being his mate. He decided that he was fine with this. It meant that he would not have to fight the male in the front after all. In his heart, Trevor was more of a lover than a fighter. There was only one checkout register open in the drugstore, and there was only one customer in line ahead of Castronovo. Unfortunately for him, she was the nightmare customer to be stuck behind. A woman with coupons. Worse, she was an elderly woman with coupons, of which she was clutching a stack the thickness of the Dayton, Ohio telephone directory. She had several items in her basket. At the moment, she and the cashier, a studious-looking young man in horn-rimmed glasses, were focusing on the first of these, a tube of toothpaste.
"Okay," the woman was saying, "I have a coupon for that one. I think it's 50 cents off."
She started going through her coupon stack. Behind her, Castronovo shifted his feet, rolled his eyes, and looked at his watch.
"Here it is," said the woman, handing the coupon to the cashier.
The cashier looked at it and said, "Okay, this is for Crest Complete Multi-Benefit Extra Whitening with Tartar Protection, Clean Mint."
"Isn't that what I have?" said the woman.
"No," said the cashier. "You have..." He picked up the toothpaste box and read from it. "Crest Complete, Multi-Benefit Extra White plus Scope Outlast, Lasting Mint."
"Outlast what?" said the woman.
"Lasting Mint," said the cashier. "Jesus Christ," said Castronovo, mainly to himself, but not totally.
"Okay, is this it?" said the woman, handing the cashier another coupon.
"No," he said. "This is for Crest Pure Health Clinical Gum Protection Toothpaste, Invigorating Clean Mint."
"That's a different one?"
"Yes. Also, it's not a cents off coupon. If you buy one, get one free."
"I get one free?"
"Yes, but you have to buy one."
"I am buying one."
"No, you're buying Crest Complete Multi-Benefit Extra White plus Scope Outlast, Lasting Mint."
"Okay," said the woman. "Let me see if I have a coupon for that."
"I don't believe this," said Castronovo. Brewer didn't hear the escalade coming because the baby's wails drowned out all other sounds. But he felt the jolt when its front bumper connected with the navigator. "What the hell?" he said. He turned around and saw the dark-tinted windshield of the escalade. He opened the door and quickly got out, striding around to the driver's side of the escalade. "Hey, asshole," he said. "What the fuck do you..." He stopped, seeing Seth getting out of the escalade. "What the hell are you doing here?"
"We're here to get those people," said Seth, pointing to Lorette and her children.
"No," said Brewer. "We can't let you." He stopped, mouth open, as Megan emerged from the rear of the escalade. "Megan, what the hell?"
And as Megan climbs out of the escalade, our time is up for today. Please join me again when we continue with Insane City by humorist Dave Barry. This has been Jim Beatty for GARS, the Georgia Radio Reading Service.
That's all the time we have. Thank you for joining us for Books for Night Owls. We hope you'll join us again tomorrow morning for our next installment from the Recording Library of West Texas.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, USA Today, followed by the Midland Reporter Telegram and Odessa American at 3.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 76 and clear. Mostly cloudy tonight with a low in the upper 60s. Then tomorrow, partly cloudy with a high in the mid-80s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the low 70s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 1 p.m.
Good afternoon, and welcome to your coronavirus update. It's Monday, September 14th, 2020. I'm Michael from the Recording Library of West Texas. Here are some of the things that we'll be bringing you today. In our pre-recorded stories, a woman shares story of double lung transplant to treat COVID-19. A COVID-19 vaccine may be only 50% effective. Is that good enough? When it comes to a new coronavirus relief bill, $3 trillion plus $1 trillion equals zero. Despite a new federal ban, many renters are still getting evicted. An Emory University epidemiologist on the future of COVID-19 will bring you our semi-regular segment, Ask a Doctor. Alan Alda on the importance of empathy during the COVID-19 pandemic. And Marfa Public Radio reports Quiet and Loud, how the pandemic has changed the sounds of West Texas. First, we'll take a look at the numbers. From the Odessa American, Ector County total cases both confirmed and probable, 4,454. Ector County negative, 20,698 out of 25,474 tested, with 322 pending, 82 deaths. Recovered, 3,761. Active, 611. Midland County, 3,441 confirmed, 77 deaths. From the Texas Tribune, Texas reports over 14,000 total coronavirus deaths as hospitalizations and daily new cases continue to fall. 3,319 Texans are in the hospital for the coronavirus as of September 13th, 396 less than a week ago. They occupy 5.9% of hospital beds. 1,840 new cases were reported on September 13th. The latest positivity rate is 8.1%. 14,190 Texans have died as of September 13th. 47 more deaths reported than the day before and 718 more than a week ago. West Texas Intermediate today is trading at $37.09, down 24 cents. Now here are coronavirus briefs for this Monday. Despite Nevada's ban on large indoor gatherings during the coronavirus pandemic, President Trump held a campaign rally for a massive and often maskless crowd in the city of Henderson on Sunday night. Local officials have threatened to fine or even revoke the business license of Extreme Manufacturing, the host of the event. At least 190,000 people have died of the coronavirus in the United States. More than 6,488,000 cases have been detected since February. Political appointees at the Department of Health and Human Services have sought to change, delay, and prevent the release of reports about the coronavirus by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention because they are viewed as undermining President Trump's message that the pandemic is under control. Amazon announced it will hire 100,000 new workers to meet the surging demand of e-commerce in the COVID era, bolstering an already dramatic expansion of jobs this year. Stress over the pandemic is making obsessive-compulsive disorder symptoms worse in some children, doctors say. Dentists are also seeing a surge in problems related to tooth grinding and jaw clenching in adults. The U.S. is nowhere near rounding the corner of COVID-19 cases, Dr. Anthony Fauci said in response to President Trump's comments about the virus. The Oxford University coronavirus vaccine trials will resume after being halted by an unexplained illness in one volunteer, the university said in a statement Saturday. Back-to-school outbreaks. Some schools are becoming petri dishes of disease. At least three teachers have died from complications of COVID-19 in recent weeks, according to CNN reporting and local media reports. The race for a vaccine. There are 35 potential coronavirus vaccines in human trials across the world, and countries are making plans for how they will eventually be used. China says there is no need for everyone in the country to get vaccinated, just frontline workers and high-risk populations. The World Health Organization reported the highest single-day increase in global infections since the pandemic began on Sunday. Now let's take a brief look at some areas around the world. Europe battles to fend off second wave. Europe headed for surge in coronavirus deaths in October and November, WHO Europe head says. Case numbers continue to rise in Germany, albeit more slowly than some other European countries. The Italian health ministry says six people have died of the virus in the past 24 hours, bringing the total number of pandemic deaths in Italy to 35,610. Britain's healthcare system is experiencing significant demand for coronavirus testing from people who do not have symptoms, its health department said Monday, amid reports that its testing program has a backlog of 185,000 test swabs. Switzerland has added some regions and neighboring countries to its quarantine list, according to its Department of Health. The Czech Republic set a new daily record for coronavirus infections with 1,541 new cases recorded Saturday, according to its health ministry. The spikes in cases coincides with increased testing, with an average of 15,000 people being tested every day. On Friday alone, 18,200 people took a test. Sweden has lifted its travel warning for non-essential travel to the UK. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs says the decision was taken because of the UK's reduced COVID-19 risk and will take immediate effect. Austria's leader warned Sunday that the country is starting to see a second wave of infections as it logs some of its highest daily tallies of new cases since March. Israel heads to a second lockdown as coronavirus cases soar. India reported more than 94,000 new infections Sunday, a slight fall from Saturday's new daily high. 7 months after Latin America diagnosed its first case of COVID-19, the region continues to rack up some of the worst numbers in the world, failing to flatten its curve as it reels from persistently high infection levels and devastating mortality rates. Now here at home, Texas is now third in U.S. in total coronavirus deaths. Texas has now recorded 14,405 coronavirus deaths, the third most of any U.S. state behind New Jersey and New York, according to data from Johns Hopkins University. Pfizer proposes expanding COVID-19 vaccine trial to include more diversity. The race for a coronavirus vaccine shows no signs of slowing as more companies move their vaccine candidates through clinical trials, growing closer to determining which will be considered safe and effective. One such candidate is in development by the American pharmaceutical company Pfizer, which announced, along with its German partner BioNTech, on Saturday, they proposed expanding Phase 3 clinical trials to include 44,000 participants and more diverse patient populations, including people as young as 16. That's up from the initial plan of 30,000 participants, a benchmark they plan to meet next week, according to a news release. The proposal, which would need approval by the Food and Drug Administration, would allow the companies to collect more data on the safety and efficacy of the vaccine candidate while diversifying the pool of participants. I think we should strive to have as much of a diverse population as possible, Pfizer CEO Albert Bourla told CBS on Face the Nation Sunday, stressing the importance of having a diverse group of volunteers given the heightened impact of COVID-19 that has had on communities of color. But right now, we are not bad. Actually, we have a population that globally, only 60% of Caucasians, 40% approximately minorities, he said. Pfizer CEO says there's good chance the company will know if a vaccine works by the end of October. Pfizer CEO Albert Bourla said there is quite a good chance the team testing his company's vaccine candidate for COVID-19 will know whether it works by the end of October. In our best case, we have quite a good chance, more than 60%, that we will know if the product works or not by the end of October, he said on CBS. But of course, that doesn't mean that it works. It means that we will know if it works. When asked whether people would have to wait until 2021 to receive the vaccine, Bourla said that he didn't know how long it would take for regulators to approve the drug. We have a good chance that we will know if the product works by the end of October. Then, of course, it is the regulator's job to issue a license or not, he said. Pfizer has started manufacturing the vaccine, and Bourla said hundreds of thousands of doses have already been made. Bourla said vaccine distribution will be a problem. Shipping medicines is complex, particularly when they need special storage conditions, but he said Pfizer already knows how to do it very well. As for who gets the vaccine, Bourla said that is something the authorities should decide. For example, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. 55 school staff members in New York City have tested positive for COVID-19, Mayor says. In New York City, 55 school-based staff members have tested positive for COVID-19 as a result of priority testing, Mayor Bill de Blasio said Monday. Almost 17,000 school-based staff have taken advantage of priority testing, the mayor said, returning a 0.32% positivity rate. Teachers' unions around the world clash with governments over coronavirus and school reopening plans. South Africa's teachers were in an all-too-familiar impasse. In July, coronavirus cases were on the rise, as was government pressure to reopen schools. Educators concerned about safety pushed back. As negotiations faltered, the country's largest teachers' union threatened to strike unless the start date was delayed. The government agreed to delay reopening and to add a framework for relocating teachers and students from schools that could not meet precautionary criteria. From picket lines to Zoom calls and even jail cells, the pandemic has thrust teachers' unions to the forefront of the debate over education during the coronavirus pandemic. How to safely reopen schools has become a central question, with school closures affecting well over a billion students, according to the United Nations, in addition to economies and daily life for working families. There won't be a live Macy's Thanksgiving Day parade this year, New York City mayor says. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio teased that Macy's is putting together entertainment for Thanksgiving to replace the traditional live parade coverage in light of the pandemic. It will not be the same parade we're used to. It will be a different kind of event. They are reinventing the event for this moment in history, de Blasio said. This will not be a live parade, but the experience will be online and on television, de Blasio said, not delving into details. Now we're going to bring you the first of our pre-recorded reports this Monday. Our first is a really interesting tale. A woman shares her story with us of having a double lung transplant to treat COVID-19.
Lung transplants have saved the lives of a small number of COVID patients. And Myra Ramirez is the first in the U.S. to get a double lung transplant. It was back in June, but Ms. Ramirez only recently shared her identity and her extraordinary story with Christine Herman of Illinois Public Media.
Before the pandemic struck, Myra Ramirez had built a life for herself in Chicago. She was 28 and worked as a paralegal at an immigration law firm. She loved walking her dogs and hanging out with her boyfriend. When Illinois' governor issued a stay-at-home order in March, it was easy for her to work from home. She hardly ever went outside. Myra does have a neurological condition that she manages with a medication that could have suppressed her immune system, but otherwise she's healthy. And to this day, she has no idea how she got the coronavirus. It happened sometime in early April.
I lost sense of taste and smell. I felt very fatigued. I was not able to walk long distances, and that's when I decided to go into the emergency room.
Her oxygen levels were extremely low, and Myra was given 10 minutes to call her mom to explain she was about to be placed on a ventilator.
In Spanish, the word ventilator, ventilador, is like fan. So I thought, oh, they're just going to blow some air into me and I'll be okay, maybe have a 3-day stay. So I wasn't very worried.
But in fact, she'd spend the next 6 weeks heavily sedated, with life support machines doing the work of her lungs and heart. She had terrifying dreams that she couldn't distinguish from reality.
Most of them involved me drowning, and I attribute that to me not being able to breathe. I had way worse nightmares than that, but I don't wish to share those because they're very explicit.
In early June, Myra's family was told she may not make it through the night, so they flew in from North Carolina to say goodbye. Then the doctor said they could try a double lung transplant. Her mother, Noemi Romero, agreed. She spoke at a recent press conference about the experience. She said there are no words to describe the pain of not being by her daughter's side as she struggled for her life, and that God gave her the strength to make it through. Northwestern Medicine's Dr. Ankit Bharat performed the 10-hour procedure.
Most patients are quite sick going into lung transplant, but she was so sick. In fact, I can say without hesitation, the sickest patient I've transplanted.
Myra was extremely sick, but she was also young, just 28. And aside from her lungs, her other organs were relatively okay. Bharat says most COVID-19 patients are not like Myra. They're not candidates for transplants because of their age and other chronic health problems that make it less likely a transplant will succeed. When Myra first woke up, she was disoriented. She couldn't move or talk. It would be weeks before she understood what had happened to her. She's doing better now, but probably faces at least a year of rehab therapy before she can function independently.
At this time, I'm not certain of the permanent damage that's been made to my body. I don't even want to begin to talk about the pills because there are so many.
17 different pills, some of them several times a day. Some are to prevent her body from rejecting the new lungs. And she also takes depression and anxiety meds because she has so many nightmares and panic attacks.
Slowly but surely, I'm able to get through them with the help of therapy. It's just something that I don't want to relive ever again.
COVID-19 has disproportionately harmed Latinos, who are overrepresented in low-wage jobs that expose them to the virus and are more likely to lack social protections like health insurance. Even with her work-from-home job, Myra wasn't spared. And while insurance covered some of her hospitalization, she still owes tens of thousands of dollars in medical bills. Myra is eager to get back to her job and her life. She's even asked her surgeon to take her skydiving someday.
It's funny because Dr. Bharat actually used to work at a skydiving company when he was younger. And so he promised me that hopefully within a year, he can get me there.
And she has every intention of holding him to that promise. For NPR News, I'm Christine Herman in Urbana, Illinois.
That story comes from NPR's partnership with Side Effects Public Media and Kaiser Health News.
In our next story, we turn to vaccines. A COVID-19 vaccine may be only 50% effective. Is that good enough?
We have now surpassed 6.5 million cases of the coronavirus in the United States. The virus is still circulating widely, but new cases are down significantly, dropping about 20% over the last week or so. NPR's Allison Aubrey joins us, as she does on most Mondays, to talk about where we are in all this. Allison, thanks for being here.
Good morning, David.
So I so want to believe that these numbers are suggesting something encouraging here. I mean,
yes.
Am I safe feeling a little encouraged about this decrease?
You know, yeah, I'd say over the last week, there have been about 35,000 cases per day documented, new cases. That's a significant decrease from the 60,000 we were seeing back in July. Deaths are declining too. So yes, there are signs of improvement, but the pandemic is not behind us, right? I mean, as we head into fall, infectious disease experts say there's a good chance we'll see an increase in cases as people, you know, spend more time congregating inside. And given that we don't yet have a vaccine, it's really important to remain vigilant.
Well, I mean, let me ask you about that vaccine. What is the latest, and what are the chances that we are going to have a vaccine that is effective enough anytime soon to make us feel better about this?
You know, it's not clear how effective the vaccine will be, but here's a bit of a reality check. Anthony Fauci has tried to set expectations by saying that the vaccine may only be about 50% effective. You know, everyone hopes for a higher rate of efficacy, but in fact, the FDA has said that if a vaccine is shown to be safe and at least 50% effective, it could be approved.
I mean, that's quite a reality check. I think a lot of us were thinking, like, it might be safe to, you know, with our loved ones with comorbidities, we can go visit
them. Right, thinking of it as a magic bullet. Yeah,
not that at all, it sounds like.
You know, it's not. It means if 100 people get the vaccine, 50 of them could still end up getting infected with the virus. Now, there's still benefit there. I mean, infectious disease experts are hoping that it would be similar to the flu vaccine in terms of reducing the severity of illness, meaning that, you know, if you're a person who gets the vaccine and ends up getting sick with the virus, the hope is you won't get as sick. You know, you'd be less likely to end up in the hospital. But it's sort of too soon to say the extent to which this will be the case. The other reality check, David, is that lots of people, the majority of people, need to be vaccinated in order for us to reach a sort of herd immunity to this virus.
Well, and that seems like a real potential problem, because you have a lot of Americans saying that they're very hesitant to get a COVID-19 vaccine whenever it is approved. Is that changing, or are efforts to get more people on board effective?
You know, an NPR PBS Marist poll found back in August that more than a third of Americans, so 35%, say they won't get vaccinated when a vaccine becomes available. And in recent weeks, David, with concerns about political pressure to have a vaccine before the November presidential election, you know, it seems that just it has made more people hesitant. I spoke to Robert Wynn about this. He's a physician in Richmond, Virginia. He's been advising faith leaders at a number of black churches. He says he definitely hears this hesitance in the African-American community he's a part of. He says he's not at all surprised that black patients are among the most reluctant to participate in clinical trials of the vaccine.
And, you know, this is built on a history of having almost no to little trust to begin with. I mean, if you think back to, you know, the United States Public Health Study in 1932, otherwise the Tuskegee Study, I think that that history now, on top of an eroding sense of trust and an eroding sense of where you can get accurate information, is really adding to an illogical sort of mistrust and enhanced distrust of the system.
And he says this is really very unfortunate, right? His take is that this distrust is very widespread, well beyond the African-American community. So the message that he's trying to get out is this.
Do we need a vaccine? We absolutely need a vaccine. A good vaccine does two things. It prevents people from getting the infection, and it reduces the symptoms if you get it. But now there is resistance and mistrust and distrust about taking even a good vaccine at this moment. And so I think it has been the most disheartening couple of weeks for me.
You know, he says there's just such a loss of trust.
Yeah, a loss of trust and entrenched distrust. Can trust be rebuilt on something like this?
I mean, there's an attempt to do this. 9 companies, including the CEOs of AstraZeneca, Moderna, Pfizer, signed a safety pledge last week promising not to submit their vaccine candidates to the FDA for review until their safety and efficacy is documented, really nailed down. But Robert Wynn says, you know, there's this sentiment out there that no one wants to volunteer to be first. They want to see how the vaccine works for others. He says he hears this a lot.
It might work, but let it work on other people first, and then we might decide to jump in. And I think the unfortunate thing is that if we all just wait for somebody else to get it done, it just delays us getting a vaccine that works, which means more people are going to get sick, means more people are going to die. I mean, that's just the fact of how this all works out and plays out.
Now, the first group to be offered a vaccine will likely be essential workers, healthcare workers. So clearly, trust within that community is key.
Can I just ask you, I mean, this is something we've been covering at NPR a lot. I mean, the situation in college campuses that have been reopening. You had some that reopened and then had to close for in-person learning. I mean, really quickly, because COVID cases shot up. What are we looking at right now?
You know, I think it's highly variable. There have been more than 80,000 cases reported on campuses. I spoke to Aaron Carroll about this at Indiana University. He's a physician. He says the infection rate in dorms there is quite low, and there's actually no evidence of spread inside classrooms where students are distanced and masked. But in the Greek system, so sororities and fraternities, there are very high rates of infection.
It depends week to week. We have some fraternities where I think it's gotten above 80%, where it's very likely that soon all of them will be infected if they are not already. Overall, we've had no significant illnesses, no hospitalizations at this point, but the spread in our Greek system has been significantly higher than we would like.
So this is not an environment where it's easy to stop the spread.
In Paris, Allison Arbery. Thanks, Allison.
Thank you, David.
Now turning to the economy. When it comes to a new coronavirus relief bill, $3 trillion plus $1 trillion equals zero. Here's this from the Texas Standard.
This is the Texas Standard. We're now 53 days away from Election Day, and for many incumbents, that general election will be, to some extent at least, a referendum on how well they have handled the coronavirus emergency. And with millions of Texas lives and livelihoods on the line, demands for further relief continue. Now, earlier this week, as Congress went back to work on Capitol Hill, job one was finding a way to provide such relief. Alas, on this Friday, we cannot report to you that lawmakers have passed a new package. And Tom Benning of the Dallas Morning News reports this apparent gridlock could well have major ripple effects in Texas politics. Tom joins us now from Washington. Welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
So let's talk a little bit about the implications here, because we were just talking earlier this week with Senator John Cornyn, and it sounded like there was, something like a $2 trillion chasm between what it was that Democrats were pushing for and what it was that Republicans on the Hill wanted?
I think that's a pretty good summary right there. I mean, it maybe depends a little bit on the day, but, you know, months ago, the House Democrats passed a $3 trillion bill. We've seen Republicans put forward a $1 trillion counteroffer, and then this week they move forward with a procedural vote on a $500 billion narrower option, knowing there weren't the votes to proceed. So, as you mentioned, we're pretty much stuck at nothing, despite there being repeated efforts at talks, you know, multiple ideas put forward, general agreement on the need for something to happen, and, you know, often cases a consensus on the areas that really need help. But with the election day approaching and election season complications factoring in, it's looking increasingly likely that there will be no additional coronavirus relief provided until after the election.
$3 trillion plus $1 trillion equals zero. That's pretty horrifying math. So when you step back from it, though, what substantively seems to be the problem? Because there are a lot of people here in Texas and across the nation, frankly, struggling just to make ends meet, and a lot of people begging for Congress to do something.
Of course. And you hear from a lot of lawmakers who agree that something needs to be done. But I guess the real stumbling block is over on the first level. It's over the scope of the package. The Democratic package is kind of a grab all of, you know, it would send out another round of stimulus checks. It would provide additional money to the Paycheck Protection Program. It would increase the unemployment benefit, the enhanced unemployment benefit at a $600 per week rate. The Republicans have agreed on some of those ideas, but maybe at a smaller scale. They have put forward an idea to do the unemployment benefits at $300 per week, or in their $500 billion bill they put forward this week, they didn't have the stimulus checks. So you have disagreement over that of just how much and exactly where the money could go. But the problem is then you start tinkering, right? The lawmakers, they say, well, we want to get some votes here from this area, and that in some cases adds further complications. So one area that the Republicans have focused on is a provision that Senator John Cornyn has authored to provide liability protection for businesses as it relates to the coronavirus. And that's a no-go for many Democrats. So you put that in the mix, and then you're just one, you know, another potential stumbling block there, and on and on. So, you know, if they can't come to agreement on the top line numbers, it really kind of gets more difficult from there once you start throwing other provisions and ideas in the mix.
Well, it sounds like from what you're describing that election year politics are a big part of the issue of stalemate here. But what I'm wondering is, what are the ripple effects that you've noticed? Because you believe that, as I understand it, this will have ramifications in these congressional races that are upcoming.
Sure. I mean, the bottom line is that, you know, Texans, constituents, voters, they don't really care about that Congress is gridlocked or that they can't, they don't really, what they want is results. And so that means that, and that goes on both sides. So you have someone like John Cornyn who's up for re-election. He's, you know, a part of leadership on the Republican side in the Senate. And you're seeing his opponent, MJ Hager, really hammer him over where are the results. Now Cornyn, of course, flips the blame back at Democrats. And you see that in other races in Texas at the congressional level where, for instance, in the Dallas area, Representative Colin Allred, a freshman lawmaker, his Republican opponent, Genevieve Collins, is kind of casting the same message toward him of where are the results. And so I guess it really comes down to people are struggling and they need help, and they're going to look for someone to blame. And it ultimately, it's going to depend on who they see as more to blame. And we don't fully know the answer to that of how that we perceived. But there is a real danger for lawmakers who are in office and who have tough races to get something done.
Tom Benning, reporter for the Dallas Morning News, will link to his latest at texasstandard.org. Tom, thanks again.
Thank you.
Because COVID-19 is coming from a novel coronavirus, it's very hard to predict what it will do. But in this report, an Emory University epidemiologist gives his thoughts on the future of COVID-19.
This week, at some point, we will reach a grim new milestone. 200,000 Americans dead from COVID-19. And yet, alarm about the disease seems to be diminishing among some. A new poll in Wisconsin by the Marquette Law School finds 38% of respondents say they are not very worried or not worried at all by the virus. This, as journalist Bob Woodward released tapes of President Trump revealing that the president purposefully downplayed the coronavirus in public while early on privately acknowledging how lethal it is.
It's also more deadly than your strenuous flus. This is deadly stuff.
More on the political fallout from those comments in a moment. We begin this hour with our next guest, who says there may be reasons for hope. Carlos del Rio is an epidemiologist with Emory University in Atlanta, and he joins us now.
Happy to be with you, Lulu.
You are cautiously optimistic. Why?
Well, I think we're beginning to see in many parts of the country, including here in Georgia, a decrease in the number of cases. On a national level, we've seen over the last 2 weeks a 13 to 15% decrease in the number of cases. We are seeing also some places where the cases are increasing. I worry mostly right now about North and South Dakota. But in general, we see in the U.S., 10 states where the cases were high and are now coming down, and that's good to see.
Testing, though, has also gone down. Could that not be a product of the fact that testing has slowed down instead of actual infection rates going down?
It certainly could, but I don't think testing has gone down as much as cases have. And at the end of the day, we are seeing other indicators coming down, most importantly, the number of people hospitalized. And I really think looking at who gets in the hospital and what happens to hospitalizations, it's a very good indicator of really the severity of disease.
We have seen the number of deaths slowing, but that has happened in other countries only to see the numbers surge again. Is that a concern?
Well, it's very interesting because the decrease in the deaths has not been as significant so far as the decrease in cases that we've seen in this country. You're seeing close to 1,000 deaths per day in this country, and that hasn't changed much. And I think part of it is that we're not having one epidemic, right? We're having multiple epidemics. So, for example, in the Northeast, deaths have really plummeted. But here in the South, they almost are staying stable, and some other places are actually going up. The other thing that we've seen, Lulu, is an increase in cases among young people, and a lot of it is related to college towns. And as a result of that, you know, young people get infected, but they don't get as sick, and therefore they don't die. So part of the issue is that the epidemiology that we have today is very different than the epidemiology we had back in March or April.
Bearing all that in mind, we are still closing in on 200,000 deaths in this country. The United States has been the epicenter globally of this pandemic. What has been the biggest failure so far in your view?
You know, I think we have had a failure of leadership, and the administration essentially gave it to the states and said, let's each state do its own strategy. This lack of coordination, lack of a national strategy has really hurt us because you have states making very different recommendations. And the White House Coronavirus Task Force, honestly, when they put the recommendations of how to open, they were very clear on what needed to be done. There were very clear metrics that you had to follow to open. And many states just essentially chose to ignore those recommendations. So we really have not had a national strategy, and we're paying the consequences of that.
I'd like to ask you where you see the science right now. Have we gotten better at treating COVID-19? What have we learned?
One thing that has been particularly successful, I would say, is the scientific response. And again, I'm biased because I am one of the scientists, but I would tell you the way internationally there's been coordination and scientific response, the way pharmaceutical companies have worked together in unprecedented ways, it's really something that I think we need to be all proud of. You know, think about, we went from describing a new virus and posting the genetic sequence of a new virus to having a vaccine delivered into a human in 62 days. That is absolutely amazing. Never, ever before had something like that happen. You know, we have major vaccines. There are three or four vaccines now in phase three trials, so they're in the trials for efficacy. We're really moving at incredible speed, and that is a result of leadership. And I think, you know, Operation Warp Speed and many other things that have been done have actually been examples of what needs to happen when we think about other diseases like cancer, for example.
And yet one of the great tragedies and scandals of this pandemic is how it is disproportionately impacting communities of color. Do you see any improvement there?
You know, unfortunately, I don't. And I think that the disparities that we're seeing in this pandemic are not new. We have had enormous healthcare disparities in this country that we have not addressed. And my hope is that as a result of this pandemic, we are going to begin to look at what we need to do to improve the racial and ethnic disparities that have been so just unacceptable in this pandemic.
So, Dr. Dalrio, how do you see this pandemic ending and when?
Well, first of all, I would like to make it very clear that a vaccine is going to be important, but it's not going to be the end game. People are talking about having a vaccine that has an efficacy of 50%. So that means, you know, you give it to 100 people, half of them are protected, half of them are not protected. And that's in the best of circumstances. So we need to continue incorporating the non-pharmacological measures of masking and social distancing and hand washing together with the vaccine. We will eventually get to enough people infected and enough people vaccinated that then you will get to herd immunity. But that's not going to happen in my mind before, you know, a year, year and a half from now. So my goal is by Christmas of 2021, we will be on our way out.
Epidemiologist Carlos Del Rio of Emory University, thank you very much.
Happy to be with you.
Alan Alda, who is best known as Hawkeye in the hit TV show MASH, started a center focused on communicating scientific information to the public. Here he is on how the dearth of empathy is affecting pandemic messaging.
You are listening to the Texas Standard.
Time now to turn to your questions about COVID-19. We've been asking you to drop us a line about anything you want to know about the coronavirus, and we're doing our best to get answers once a week. With Dr. Fred Campbell, he is a doctor of internal medicine and associate professor of medicine at the Long School of Medicine, UT Health San Antonio. Dr. Campbell, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
It's always a pleasure to be of help, David.
This week's questions concern some of the headlines we've seen lately regarding COVID-19. Many schools around Texas are now, or will soon, if they have not yet, gone back to school in person. What signs or symptoms should parents be on the lookout for, and what should they do if they observe any of them?
Fortunately, young people have relatively mild problems with COVID-19, with relatively uncommon exceptions. The initial symptoms typically are going to be fever, fatigue, and a dry cough. Sometimes other symptoms such as a sore throat or headache may occur, and even more uncommon would be loss of taste or smell. Mm-hmm. But in general, if people are not having shortness of breath, they typically run a mild course.
Of course, and you also want to make sure that your child stays away from in-school attendance, I would imagine.
Absolutely. The risk of passing COVID-19 is very high, even in young people, and of course then disseminating that to much higher risk individuals mm-hmm. in their homes.
Let's shift gears a bit, because it's been a little chilly here in Texas for a good part of the state, at least late in the week. And I noticed that L.A. County has already canceled Halloween trick-or-treating this year. October's not that far away. Do you think there's a way to make trick-or-treating safe, or should parents plan to forego it in 2020?
Well, this may be one of the toughest questions I've been given, and it's certainly very important. In my community of San Antonio, for instance, local officials are really looking toward how good our citizens have been over the Labor Day holidays in terms of reducing any kind of a spike after the last weekend. But if, in fact, there is a reduction in the number of cases, it's possible that some form of trick-or-treating could occur. I would personally recommend that perhaps older children and youth take the lead and perhaps get treats that they could bring home to their much younger brothers and sisters who aren't going to be able to mask or social distance very well. So that's an idea that I have.
Find a costume, too, perhaps with some kind of facial covering. That might help.
Absolutely. Yeah. Could be a fun thing, but everybody has to be very, very aware of the potential problems.
Indeed.
A lot of chatter lately about a timeline for COVID-19 vaccine. I'm sure you've heard a bit of it. Once a vaccine does become available, as most are presuming it will eventually, what information should people be looking for in order to be confident when taking it?
Confidence is such an important aspect of an effective vaccination campaign. I'm glad you asked that question. The general thinking about vaccination for COVID-19 is that it needs to be fairly effective, and that means somewhere in the vicinity of 80% effective in building antibodies against COVID-19. Then if maybe three-quarters of the population is vaccinated, hopefully 100% eventually, but at least three-quarters, then we will develop what's called herd immunity, which can really, really dramatically drop the chance of getting further infection.
We've been speaking with Dr. Fred Campbell. He is a doctor of internal medicine at the Long School at UT Health San Antonio, and we're having him join us regularly over the course of the coronavirus pandemic to answer your questions. Now, if you have something that you would like to ask Dr. Campbell, you can look for us on Twitter, Facebook, or go over to texasstandard.org/coronavirus. You'll find a form right there to submit your questions. Dr. Campbell, thanks so much for joining us again, and as always, stay safe.
Same to you, David, and likewise.
This weekend featured the first games of the college football season. On Friday, Austin columnist Ross Ramsey wrote an analysis. College football is back as both a spectacular and a science experiment.
This is Ross Ramsey's Unconventional Wisdom, brought to you by introducing Nativo Austin, downtown's first purposefully built, licensed Airbnb-friendly building. Fully furnished condos from the 500,000s. Delivery fall 2021. Find out more at nativoaustin.com.
This is Ross Ramsey from the Texas Tribune. Today's column, college football is back as both a spectacular and a science experiment. Texas's college football players won't be the only people with butterflies in their stomachs this weekend. They're just the most public players in the state's reopenings of educational institutions, a fraught statewide foray into in-person education, live arena events, and the kinds of young adult interactions that have made coronavirus hotspots of campuses and college towns across the country. Texas Christian University and Southern Methodist University were supposed to play today, but canceled when some TCU players and staff tested positive for COVID-19. SMU played last Saturday against Texas State University, but the TCU-SMU game would have been the first involving a Big 12 school. This weekend, two Texas schools in that conference will take the field, the University of Texas at Austin and Texas Tech University. A third was supposed to play, but Baylor University postponed its weekend game after several Louisiana Tech players tested positive. Texas State will play again, this time against UT San Antonio. Returning to school is a test for the students, the schools, and the state. Returning to football with its wider audience and high visibility raises the stakes. Not everyone has followed the stories about COVID-19 cases at colleges in Texas and elsewhere. Search the internet for COVID and the name of your favorite school, and you'll get a quick peek. For a lot of places, things are going well. Either the students know what they're doing, the schools know what they're doing, or both. Lots of places aren't so lucky. The New York Times surveyed 203 counties in America where students make up at least 10% of the population, college towns, basically. Half of those had their worst pandemic weeks after August 1st. Half of those, in turn, were at their all-time peak for coronavirus infections. Many schools have COVID-19 dashboards to keep everybody up to date. There's one at UT Austin where cases have jumped in the last couple of weeks. Another at Texas A&M University tells a similar story, that cases rise when school starts and the population swells. Increases in coronavirus cases were expected. The question, and it's still unanswered at this point, is whether it's wise, on balance, to reopen in the way Texas colleges have reopened. In the meantime, the most visible results tend to be the negative ones, and the blame tends to be aimed at students, especially when they're off campus and not at the administrators and others running the schools. If you put a bunch of young people together away from home with plenty of free time, you don't get something you've never seen before. You get what you'd expect. But the students are the reopening vanguard for the rest of us. Some schools planned for this better than others. Some were ready to handle coronavirus outbreaks. Others were still learning. For instance, schools that had been sending sick students home are now keeping them on campus in quarantine, where they don't take a contagious disease back to their families and their hometowns. Students, like everyone else, are looking for ways to blow off steam, to enjoy their leisure time. At the moment, they're shut out of bars, restaurants, and other gathering places. Swimming pools and river tubing and similar adventures are off limits. As Karen Brooks Harper reported for the Texas Tribune, the responses vary. Baylor is cracking down to see that students don't get rambunctious in ways that would spread the virus. Texas A&M has asked the surrounding community to report big off-campus parties and gatherings. But now college football is back. It's one of the most visible things colleges do. It's full of built-in social distancing violations, too, with crowded arenas, tailgate parties, house parties, sports bars, and all the rest. All of that is supposed to be on hold this year, or tamped down to a non-threatening size. The players have their own risks. Remember those TCU and Louisiana Tech examples. Students, on the whole, have had their own risks since they began drifting back to campus for the fall semester. Now the fans will be tested, and in two ways. They'll either behave or not. It's just as easy to spread a virus if everybody gets together in front of a TV set as it would be at a tailgate. Second is the test that's of interest to people in college administration, in government, and in politics. Whether it's smart to proceed with a season of college football during this pandemic and with a semester of students gathering on and around the campuses of the colleges that field the teams. This is Ross Ramsey. Thanks for listening.
Alan Alda, who is best known as Hawkeye in the hit TV show MASH, started a center focused on communicating scientific information to the public. Here he is on how the dearth of empathy is affecting pandemic messaging.
Has dipped 16 points. Dr. Anthony Fauci, the National Institutes of Health's top infectious disease expert, has seen his numbers dip by 10%, and large numbers of the public also hold dangerous misconceptions. For instance, 20% of Americans believe wearing a mask is harmful to their health. In short, Americans are confused and mistrustful of the people who are supposed to get us out of this health crisis, and some of this can be blamed on the mixed messaging we've been hearing. We're joined now by Alan Alda, who has dedicated a big part of his life to changing the way science is communicated to the public. Welcome.
Thank you.
Some people may not know this, but you are very seriously invested in making sure the public gets clear messaging on issues that involve science. You even have a center at Stony Brook University dedicated to this. Clearly, there have been some communication failures here in this pandemic. Give me a top line. What is the main thing that has gone wrong in the communication, in your view, so far?
The thing that worries me the most is that we seem to have a lowering of our compassion for one another, not so much compassion as empathy. And the way I think of empathy is not as compassion. Compassion is feeling sorry for somebody to some extent, but empathy is getting a reading as well as you can of what they're going through, what they may be suffering from. And that's important to think about them as clearly as you think about yourself and protecting them. But I think this pandemic is a real test of our empathy.
There have been confusing messages, though, coming in terms of the science, certainly from the president. But I'd like to focus on how scientists and public health experts have also said some contradictory things. You know, Dr. Anthony Fauci himself initially said, don't wear a mask. Now we understand that was because they wanted PPE for health workers. When a mistake like that is made, what should happen, do you think, in terms of communicating science clearly to the public?
You know, it's not always a mistake when science says one thing and then sometime later says another thing. One of the problems in communicating about science, I think I've found, is that people aren't comfortable with one of the basic elements of science, which is that no one study solves everything for all time. It's a march toward a greater understanding of reality. Isaac Newton saw gravity one way, Einstein saw it another. Doesn't mean one of them is wrong. It just means that considering certain aspects of the whole picture, you get a different conclusion.
That's right. And so many studies are happening right now during this pandemic, and we're constantly learning new things. But data can be confusing and contradictory, as you note. How do you tell the public clearly what they should be doing when the guidance changes?
I think it's a good idea to keep them up to date on what we now believe we know to be true through rigorous studies. At the same time, I think it's a good idea to constantly remind people that this is what we know for now and it's liable to change. It avoids the confusion that's born of the fact that most people don't spend their lives studying science the way scientists do, and they're not used to the process. It doesn't make them less smart. They've spent their lives doing other things that are important to do. But they may not be familiar enough with the idea that the view of nature changes as science moves on.
In an article in Scientific American, Mehta Shah, who is an assistant professor of emergency medicine at Rush University Medical Center in Chicago, wrote about the messaging failures, as she put it, by health officials and scientists. It opened with this line, quote, "It seems science is lost and politics is won in the battle against COVID-19 here in the United States." Do you think that's true?
No, I don't think the battle is lost. We're smart enough and good enough at heart to help one another out. We're all neighbors. Contempt, I don't think, ever won an argument. But it can start a fight. And the last thing we need to do when our lives are at stake is to start fighting with each other. Now wearing a mask is a mark of division. It's hard because we have reached a point in our understanding of science where for too many people, science is just another opinion. Rather, it's some of our best brains working on problems that are a question of life and death for all of us.
That's Alan Alda, whose Alan Alda Center for Communicating Science at Stony Brook University trains scientists and doctors in how to explain science to the public. He also has a podcast, Clear and Vivid with Alan Alda. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lulu. It was fun talking with you.
Finally today, we have a report from Marfa Public Radio. They have begun a new series called Quiet and Loud. Here at the Recording Library, our mission is to bring you audio. And this is a unique series. They're exploring the way the pandemic has changed the soundscape of West Texas. So we're very excited to be able to bring this to you, combining the mission of this program related to the pandemic with audio. In this series, they're exploring the way the pandemic has changed the soundscape of West Texas. One of the first places they're visiting is the desert expanse of Big Bend National Park, where the pandemic has led to two closures and restricted visitors to daytime use only.
This is Morning Edition on Marfa Public Radio. Today, we're exploring how the sounds of West Texas have changed since the pandemic began. In our new series called Quiet and Loud, we'll travel across the region to record how our environments have transformed. Our first stop, Big Bend National Park, where the pandemic has forced the park to close twice already. Visitors there are now allowed to return for day use only, but the number of hikers is still far below normal. Marfa Public Radio's Carlos Morales filed this audio postcard from the park.
Just heard a cactus ran in the background. That's one of the loudest players in the ensemble here in Big Bend. They sing and call and they have this wide repertoire of kind of choking, croaking. There's another one. Almost sounds like at times like a rusty engine that can't start over and over and over again. Yeah, my name is Tom Vandenberg. I'm the Chief of Interpretation and Visitor Services at Big Bend National Park. On a typical day, you really wouldn't be hearing much as far as birds right out front of park headquarters. There'd be a lot of traffic, a lot of people coming and going. But none of that, you know, that first day it was like, wow, this is quiet. This is strange. At the point where we are right now, it's day use only. So we have, we're getting about 20 to 40 cars a day, which seems really, really low. But, you know, they're not able to spend much time. They're doing a lot of scenic drives through the park and heading up to the Chisos Mountains where it's a little cooler. Lots of hiking trails up there.
Hearing the rocks under my feet, the sound of the stone, I mean, it's great. So clear to hear the birds and the sound of the wind hitting the bushes out here. It sounds different. It's live.
Even when it passes over the ridge, you can hear something and you know it can't be people. It can't be car noise, because there is none of that right now. It's just the wind through the trees, and it's beautiful.
now there's an appreciation for this that we sort of took for granted before. So it feels like a privilege to be able to come back out here again.
Well, as we get into the evening hours, you will probably be, you know, one of the only visitors in the entire 800,000-acre national park. And so I'm kind of curious as to what you might hear.
During the night, it almost is a little bit, there's like a little bit more noise in a way because you've got all the bugs, like the night bugs. My name is Ari Snyder. I'm the Morning Edition host at Marfa Public Radio, and I'm new to West Texas, and this is my first time in Big Bend National Park.